What up, y'all, and welcome back to At the Table, where we discuss the most pressing issues of today with everyday folks like you and me, and whenever possible, we break bread together. As we gear up for another season of episodes, we wanted to highlight five special moments from the previous 17 episodes that either you may have missed because we didn't share it, or it was a standout moment for us. You should know that each episode is important to us, and just like healthy food, these are rich in substance, so I definitely encourage and would appreciate you catching up on earlier episodes that interest you. You can do that at atthetabletalks.com or youtube.com/fitmencook. Now, without further delay, here's number five. I share this clip of the elite personal trainers from episode 3 as they are distinguishing between mental toughness versus mental weakness and the mindset it truly takes to overcome obstacles.
I want to talk about the need to be like mentally tough and what goes through your mind in those moments where you're not feeling as powerful.
I feel like to be fitness enthusiast, athlete, chef, I mean, just work every regular everyday job, you got to have some form of mental toughness.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times going to be days that you don't want to do it. Like, I mean, I think my mindset may be a little different because, like, I have the hunger to be great, like, every day. And I compete against myself every day. I mean, I just like it. You know what I mean? I like that feeling of, you know what I'm saying? Like, so a lot of times people get lost by competing with other people all the time, whether it's on social media, whether it's in everyday life, whether it's how somebody looks, what kind of car they drive, like what kind of house they live in. I tell people, like, you're going to drive yourself crazy doing that because you'll never know what that person's going through, right?
Yeah.
From a toughness standpoint, they could be miserable, right? You know what I'm saying? So I'll tell you, just, like, focus on you and do you every day. You'll be a lot happier in life. It's kind
of, I love that. You compete against yourself.
Every day.
Can you teach mental toughness?
Yeah, you can. I mean, like, say with me, okay. I just hate excuses, though.
You can tell he's already bothered by it. Like, I don't know. Don't come to my gym week.
It's hard.
Yeah,
I'm not like hard, but I'm like, listen, like, you're here for a reason. You might hate you came. You know what I'm saying? When you walked in the door, but you're never going to hate that you came when you left. Kind of like the approach, but like I take the same like mental mindset with regular everyday people as I do my athletes.
People don't necessarily realize that it is a daily practice to be mentally tough. It's a daily practice to not necessarily work through pain, whether that's literally or figuratively speaking, but to not run away from it. But the actual mental talk that happens is a daily practice that all of us have to do. And some people just obviously have more practice and are a little bit more equipped to do it, and others still are like just inching their way there.
Mm-hmm. Does it matter how you talk to yourself?
There are times when you get down, right? There's like when you face obstacles, like, man, am I good enough?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I hear that, it triggers me, like, because that's not of me. Like, that's not why I feel like I was created. Like, that negativity doesn't belong inside of me. It's not going to add anything to me. That worry or that doubt is not going to add anything to my situation. So that's a trigger. When I hear myself doing that, it's going to be like, okay, Justin, you know better than this. Like, so I'm always constantly trying to positively reinforce those affirmations.
At number 4, this clip from episode 4 drew probably the most chatter on and offline. The guest, John Lewis, a badass vegan, explained why he stands behind the notion that Black people may be eaten like slaves by eating and preparing the foods our ancestors created from scraps during slavery.
The post was, if we aren't slaves anymore, why are we still eating like that? So that's what it was.
Yeah.
And to go along with what you're saying is that, you know, you felt that it was disrespectful to the slaves and what they went through, enslaved people, because I'm working on terminology now, those that were enslaved. But my take is, I think it's disrespectful to not to keep doing that. They were forced to do it.
Correct.
I think they went through the battleground and went through the fucked up shit so we don't have to do it anymore. So it's like, I think it's more disrespectful to keep doing it when we don't have a whip on our back, when we're not living in a cottage. That's me. So it's like, our ancestors went through so much so that we wouldn't have to go through it anymore.
So we would have a choice.
But if the choice is not good for us.
Well, that's your own interpretation, right?
Yeah.
Because veganism.
That was my interpretation on my page, right?
Yeah, okay, correct. Well, of also the food though, right? Because there are certain things, but if so, it's nuanced, right?
Right.
Because I actually tend to agree with you a little bit more
now.
Honestly,
that was like four years ago.
It does line up with the same thinking from earlier in the conversation, where it's like, even just whatever, hunter-gatherer, like even before slave times, it's like people all across the world ate what they had. You know, mm-hmm. if you live near the ocean, you're eating a lot of fish.
Yeah.
If you live inland, you're eating cow. You're mm-hmm. still eating vegetables and stuff right. like that. They didn't necessarily have a choice because they right. needed to survive.
Right.
But now we live in a day and age when
we do
have
exactly.
a choice.
Yes, we got yeah. a choice. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think a thing to realize too is there was a choice back then. The knowledge wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Not saying that anybody was stupid. It's just, I mean, look. Like, literally, look at what we're doing right now. We're sitting mm-hmm. at a table with cameras around, microphones.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't have that fucking option back then.
Right.
The if somebody did learn about a certain way to eat, a certain way to live, by the time they got the information, it was 100 years later because it took that long for the information to get over to another. Like, right. literally, by the time we post this, it's going to spread to 700 countries.
Yeah.
I think there's only 260 something. Like, but whatever.
Yeah.
It's going to spread to everybody. So I think there's so many factors that we have to put into play for today that just wasn't there back then.
Right.
And once we do that, and I think too, because I get emotional about shit too. Like, I've had to learn, like, really take emotion out of a lot of stuff. Like,
yeah.
you know, like, yeah, I know that's an emotional topic to talk about what slaves eat and how they lived. But I also, like, all right, would the enslaved people care about our feelings today, or would they care about us living our best life? You know what I'm saying? They're mm-hmm. like, look, I went through this. Look what I went through. For you to be like, you know what, cool, I'm going to have a double bacon.
Right.
And I'm taking Lipitor while I'm eating it.
Right. And that's what people do. And,
yeah.
And sadly. Now, I would say this, the, you know, the only thing about that is that if people want to make that one time of year because it was grandma's recipe and whatnot, and this has been passed on, I don't think it's necessarily fair to put them in the same category as eating like a slave. Now, a person that was eating like a slave, first off, just that terminology, that actually means like a perpetual state. Like, you are, that is your regular diet. That's
yeah.
your, you know, right?
Yeah.
But if I sit down at someone's house, at my mom's house, and they're and she's making a recipe that's been passed down for generations, I'm going to say that's not eating like a slave. That's going to be, I'm honoring the past. And so I think with veganism, going back to the whole thing about the pus sandwich, it's all connected. Does veganism have, do they have a marketing issue, like an outreach issue? Just because I feel like I'm eating my own meal. No one, absolutely no one. Why are you eating that pus sandwich? No one, absolutely no one. You eating like a slave. It doesn't mean that what you're saying is wrong, but yeah. if you're saying that if your end goal is to help people to understand what food is doing to them, I don't think that that's the right way to go around about doing it. I think whenever I mention veganism or vegans to non-vegans, all of a sudden it's like a visceral reaction. Like, oh, that's why when you said you can't tell them it's like that. It's not the fact that I think that fundamentally people desire to be healthy. People want to eat a lot more vegetables. What they don't want, though, is they don't want to be preached at. They don't want to be talked down to. That, you know, they don't want to be scolded for something that they are just, that they grew up eating. And so I really think that veganism has a really big messaging issue if they really want to get this widely adopted, because the reality is veganism is growing. Veganism is also very small. Vegans are also the loudest people in the room. And I've seen this too with my own content. Like, people be like, post more vegan stuff, post more vegan. And everyone's like, everyone's saying that. I've started posting vegan stuff.
And then other people, yeah.
Nobody. First off, people, the difference is non-vegans don't comment ugly stuff.
That's
the way that
bullshit.
Vegans.
We're gonna
come back to that. I purposely want to go and troll him because of stuff he be posting, but they don't really do that, all right? And all of a sudden, I'm like, well, where's all this enthusiasm coming from? Ah, and it hits me. Vegans are the loudest people. It represents they're a smaller minority, but they look like 80. Well, they look like 51% of the population.
Right. Yeah.
When they're really 10, less than that.
At number three, Episode 11 was less about a restrictive diet like OMAD and more so about how a 50-year-old man transformed his health and informed his new passion to inspire others to try fasting. This clip really resonated with me because he was the first to introduce the notion of not making a dietary preference so restrictive that it becomes religion more than anything else.
I tell people when they ask me about diets like OMAD, you want to make sure that it complements your lifestyle.
Yes.
So if someone is really social, they're going out and they like the happy hours, they like to talk on stuff like, you know, with friends and hang out with family, it may not be something that complements their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced something where the OMAD philosophy, the OMAD approach has been a little bit challenging?
No.
Okay.
Because
tell me about it.
Because I don't, it's not a religion for me.
Okay.
I'm not fasting because I'm trying to connect to a higher power. Fasting for health, right?
Can I just pause for a second? That was a big bar that you said. And I'm not sure, you know, it's not religion for me. I think that's where we kind of, that's the part that a dietitian or, you know, like many of them kind of deal with clients on, that it's about like your lifestyle almost to the point it's your identity. And when it's your identity, then those things, like you start to have the condemnation about changing things up or eating outside of that. And so that is, I've never heard anybody say that ever.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to just point that out. That was a really big bar.
No, it's not a religion. Fasting and OMAD is part of my lifestyle, but it's not my lifestyle. It's my lifestyle is feeling good, looking good, and being good, you know? So if a birthday party comes up, if you call me and say, hey, dude, I'm cooking up some, you know, some oxtails and I've been dedicated to OMAD for a week. Why wouldn't I say today I'm off? Today is a day of enjoying friends because I'm absorbing good energy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm hanging out with Kev. You know, I'm hanging out with these guys here and having a good time. So it's not per se something I do because it's hardcore. I'm sticking to it. This is my lifestyle. It's the way and the only way. No, it's a tool.
Right.
Fasting is a tool. So I look at it, I have that approach. If I were to give you a percentage, I'm probably OMAD 80%, 85% of the time.
Okay.
Birthdays, situations come up. I make adjustments. I might eat two meals a day. I'm always fasting. Every day I do fast. I believe I allow my body time to heal up, digest, and use up. And it's kind of goes back to what you said earlier about just that competition.
I can see that now. I didn't see that before, but once you were talking, I was like, oh, this is like a sport.
Yes.
The game is like, because it's almost like a strategy too.
Yeah.
Because you also have to set the time of the day that you feel like is going to be best for you to go ahead and eat. And so the rest of it is like, all right, how can I keep myself occupied and doing other stuff before I can get to this window of time?
Right.
But I also got to keep myself hydrated and whatnot. So it is, I mean,
it's found something that's sustainable. Because before you mentioned there was lots of like yo-yo up and trying different things. It's not working out. And this sounds like it's something that.
Uncontrolled. Yeah. You got a point.
Even if you get off for a week because you go on vacation, you know you could jump back on.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you guys are right. Yeah. I never thought about that. And hearing you talk is almost like each day was a win.
At number two, this was undoubtedly one of my favorite episodes because it deals with an issue dear to my heart. Food insecurity and access. In this clip, Luke Elzinga from Iowa Hunger Coalition outlines the economic benefits of supporting assistance programs like SNAP. Something you don't hear today.
When people are able to receive SNAP benefits, there's a lot more of adherence to take medication and whatnot. They're taking care of themselves because they have that nourishment. It's kind of like, you know what, there's one less thing for me to worry about, so now I feel empowered to go and do this. I don't have to cut the baby's formula with some water or something else because I actually have this type of nourishment like available to me. So this seems like such a small amount of money, but with much more larger consequences, though, if something like this were to pass. Why? It almost seems that they're just picking on poor people because they can.
It feels that way a lot of the time. Not to mention, I'm sure you might be familiar with the economic multiplier effect of SNAP. Every dollar that we invest in SNAP turns into $1.54 in economic activity for the state. You know, we've got rural grocery stores that are struggling right now, and SNAP is a boon to them. Because, I mean, SNAP is not an urban issue. They try to frame it that way. And I think there's some clear racial connotations there. But SNAP is just as widely used in rural areas of the state, too. And sometimes folks, you know, are needing to drive 20 miles to get to a full service grocery store. In Iowa, our food deserts are primarily in rural parts of the state. We certainly have them in urban cores too, but it's not this urban versus rural issue.
It kind of reminds me of the reasons why there have been so many protest manifestations, because it's not just about the killing of unarmed people in the streets, of unarmed Black people. It's just the Black Lives Matter. Well, Black lives do matter in just all around. And whenever you cut services like this, it just kind of shows, especially when it's a much more of an urban issue, that you're saying that those lives truly aren't as important as other lives. It just makes me wonder if it's all like connected.
Anytime we see policies under the guise of quote unquote welfare reform, there's some strong, you know, racial undertones that are implied. Mm-hmm. And in Iowa, the dog whistle here is people from Chicago. Mm-hmm. If you hear someone saying that, you know, it's code word for Black people in parts of the state. And we hear that in the legislature, you know, so that they might not come out and say it outright.
Yeah.
But there's certainly, you know, racist beliefs that are embedded in people, even if they don't realize it, you know, if they aren't realizing their own unconscious biases. We know the areas of town with the highest need are those same areas that were impacted by redlining, by urban renewal projects in the 60s and 70s. Like, there are Black and brown communities, and systemic racism ties into all these conversations around poverty and food insecurity and who's quote unquote deserving and is not.
And at number one, we are giving the final word to Dr. Ahmad Garrett Price as he teaches us how to partner with our primary care physicians and also how to better advocate for ourselves and our loved ones.
You know what the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country is?
What is it? Tell people.
Healthcare bills.
Yeah, I know.
2/3 of that being Blacks, African Americans. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is probably one of the biggest wealth transfers we don't ever talk about, ever. You're right, it's expensive, but the outcomes are the worst.
Right.
Some of the worst in the world, because the expenses caused by the diabetes when you go in and we have a $100,000 visit, whereas if we would have just said, hey, let's eat a little better, let's do this, let's do that, which, by the way, these very basic things that are cheap and inexpensive are not paid for, I will cut your leg off, though, when it gets bad. Yeah. And I'm going to charge you a ton for that. Yeah. That is the U.S. healthcare system in a nutshell.
Right.
Where we're disease and procedural focus can't help you if that's not what it is. And that's where the cost comes from, because we let people get very sick. And now they need very expensive medications. They need very expensive care. Mm-hmm. And to a certain degree, we keep you in that cycle, mm-hmm. right, until the outcomes becomes poor. Because mm-hmm. that's just the design. I keep going back to this thing. This is the design. So to your point, it's a great call out, because it's just not, this is supposed to be one of the most foremost structures to our society. Yeah. And it operates in this way. So there's heavy reframing of how we approach these things needed. And one other thing I should also say is that part of when I talk about U.S. healthcare education, a lot of it is geared towards specialization.
Right.
So you're encouraged, like when I wanted to be a family doc, it was like, why? Mm-hmm. You need to go do cardiology, be a surgeon, mm-hmm. do these things. But we need more of our talent also, and our empathetic talent, staying on the front line, if you will, so everyday people can interact with that brilliance and level of empathy. So mm-hmm. just a lot of reframing.
Right. Yeah. If people don't feel that they're getting the help that they need or the quality healthcare that they think that they are deserved, what can they do?
And so when you're in these inpatient settings, there's always a charge nurse, right? There's always an administrator there. There's always a kind of chief of that department. And you can just really go down to hospital administration and raise the concern right there. So that's one thing. And I also like to say, kind of put things in writing to a certain degree. So you have, we're big on documentation of medicine, so you can have a trail. Mm-hmm. And now on the outpatient basis, I would say that it's the same thing to a certain degree, you know, kind of understanding the quote unquote leadership structure there. But you can always move past that level that you're in. Mm-hmm. So I think of nurse administrators, I think of like chief medical officers, and I think of going directly to that administrator at that particular facility, I guess, mm-hmm. To actually raise the level. Or you could tell the doctor themselves that you're concerned, honestly, about what's going on here.
Again, y'all, come back next month in June. We are back with more conversations, more enlightening content. Catch up on earlier episodes at thetabletalks.com, as well as on YouTube at youtube.com/fitmencook. Until next time, friends, eat happy and be well.